After 3 years of work, our follow-up to the Meat Eater Fish and Game Cookbook is here. It's the Meat Eater Outdoor Cookbook, wild game recipes for the grill, smoker, campfire, and camp stove. Here is your book for everything that's best cooked or eaten outside, from grilling to open fire cooking to Dutch ovens to smokers to barbecue to backpacking meals to how to pull off the perfect fish fry. With pit stops along the way for lessons about ice age cooking methods and the best 5 ways to construct a cooking fire you can be proud of. And of course, we're focusing on wild game and fish here with over 100 recipes, including stuffed venison burgers 3 ways, wild duck with aji verde sauce, a jerky made with cola, a gin and tonic made with fire charred lemons, and grilled frog legs made with a sticky sweet sauce. This ain't your normal cookbook, so be prepared to be surprised. Get your copy now. For more info, visit themeateater.com or buy it wherever books are sold.
Hey, everybody, and welcome to episode number 15 of The Hunting Collective. I'm Ben O'Brien, and today I'm joined by none other than Ryan Callahan of First Light Hunting. And this is Ryan's second appearance in the podcast. Hopefully, we'll have him a whole bunch more times. But in this case, we were in Sonora, Texas. You joined episode number 14's guest, Casey Butler, with myself on a hunt down there for axis deer. And I'll tell you what, we had a ball. And you heard it in episode 14 if you listened. This is just a continual of that conversation with Ryan and myself. Ryan, if you haven't listened to his first episode on the Hunting Collective, you don't yet know that he is the definition of the salt of the earth. He is somebody who cares about the little things, somebody who likes struggle, likes doing things himself. He doesn't like anything automated. And it's just a privilege to be around the guy. It's a privilege to pick up on the way he looks at life, the way he simplifies his existence, and the way that he betters everyone around him. And I appreciate Ryan for all those reasons, and I think this was a great conversation. We talked about our hunt. We talked about hunting with a longbow. We talked about our feelings around record book animals and what that means. And we did it all driving in a truck, just like episode number 2. Episode number 15, we were driving in a truck, headed back to Austin, Texas, to drop him off. So with that being said, enjoy our drive home. All right, Brian Callahan, can you hear me pretty good?
Yes, Ben O'Brien.
You think this is the first podcast ever recorded where a guy was driving down the road?
You know, I would like to say that we're breaking new ground here, but I know it is not, because Dan Doty, former Meteor producer, actually recorded one, or I should say this in reverse, Joe Rogan recorded Dan Doty on the road back from a Nevada mule deer hunt.
I do remember that now that you say that. I remember that they recorded that.
That damn Joe Rogan.
I know. He comes up. Somebody said they were doing a drinking game for every time I mentioned Ranella, Remy Warren, or Joe Rogan. So get to drinking, fools. you got to take like 7 drinks already. We're only a couple minutes into this one.
Well, fortunately, it's Friday when we record this.
That's
so
true.
If you play it on a Friday, it's just a good excuse.
You can do whatever you want. Now, we started our last podcast talking about our surroundings. So it just so happens.
Oh, that's so funny. Yeah.
It just so happens we were in a truck then, and we're in a truck now. So go ahead and give me a brief description of your surroundings.
Yeah. So the greater surroundings, we just left a lovely meal in Fredericksburg, Texas. And we were sitting in Ben O'Brien's truck, and we are heading back to Austin for some early AM flights. This is post axis deer hunt, but it is in the stoplight section of Fredericksburg. I am quite interested to see if we get the same treatment that we did at the Hunt Expo when we were sitting in a truck. If people look over and see, and they wonder if we're on like a overland road race or something with these headsets on.
If we're the pit crew for a NASCAR race.
That's right.
Something like that. No, they're... No, but hopefully nobody looks at us. It's dark out. If anybody's looking in, they probably have bad intentions. Plus, we have the back of the truck is a giant Yeti cooler, a Tundra 210 to be exact, full of, would you say, 200 pounds of access to your meat? Thereabouts? Maybe a little bit.
I would say, yeah, every bit of. I was thinking our yield is pretty high because we did lots of bone-in cuts, but each deer has to be 60 pounds of yield, don't you think?
You would think so, yeah. Yeah, with the bones in, even more. So, yeah we had
four deer.
Four deer. So, we're heavy. Heavy in the bows, meat, all types of gear. We're headed back. But that was, I mean, four deer. We were there, what, 3 days?
Yes.
3 days, Canyon Ranch.
Yeah. Yeah. Oddly, big days.
Big days. Yeah. Because, you know, everybody who listened to the previous episode with our buddy Casey from Hushin knows all about the hunt. But we'll cover all that again here because we are just leaving the hunt. We're doing another podcast because why the hell not?
And God, let's just give it up to Casey. What a lamb.
Yeah.
It's just in the back seat.
Yeah. He's back there just
doing gosh knows what, really. But
yeah, I can see him glaring at me through the brake lights.
Piercing eyes. Yes.
Maybe we'll do a phone in where he can just come in and comment later on about what we're doing. Like, we have a question, he can Google it. He could be kind of like our Google guy. Like, you know, it seems like all the famous podcasters have like a fella that's there Googling the things they need to do.
The long days are, you know, it's summer. So even though, like, this is not, you're not climbing mountains out here in the hill country of Texas. Was that technically hill country?
Yeah, I will give it that. Yep.
Okay. We were outside of Sonora, Texas, and, you know, it is flat ground, like very flat ground. And it is very hot. Got a little muggy out there. There's lots of things that stick you. I am pulling lots of cactus out of myself as we speak. Chiggers, ticks, variety of wildlife was absurd. You're not exerting yourself crazily as far as like climbing mountains, but the days are very, very long. So sun doesn't set till 8, so you can shoot till 8:30, get picked up at like 9 o'clock at night, eat some food, go to bed by 11:30, get up at 4.
Yeah, it's full on. There isn't a whole lot of break.
Yeah.
And it's, I mean, the heat stays on. What were you saying? Like, it feels like a blow dryer on high heat during the day, but then in the evening it goes to medium high heat.
And it feels lovely.
It feels lovely. But yeah, I mean, it that heat takes it out of you. Anybody who's ever spent any time outside when it's 100 degrees well knows that it is not pleasant. And it drains you. It drains you. I mean, even today we hunted in the morning and then had, you know, cut up meat in the afternoon. And even, you know, today at 5 o'clock, I was like, I'm feeling like I have some energy that I haven't had in the last couple of days because you're just fighting the heat all day.
Yeah, standing in the walk-in cooler cutting meat was a nice respite.
It was a respite.
Yeah, it's pretty funny. You know, I don't like to stand around with my mouth hanging open, typically. But for some reason, I'm like, well, you know, dogs vent a lot of heat that way. So standing out there.
Here's a man who knows what he's doing.
The desert of Texas, trying to stalk down axis deer. I would occasionally be like, open your mouth. Do some heavy breathing. Maybe that'll drop your core temperature.
That'll help vent. Hey, man, you're an innovator. There's going to be a lot of hunters out there on the mountain this fall just mouth breathing.
Yeah.
Because of Ryan Callahan.
It's like, unzip your fly.
You're a true influencer.
Invent what you can. Like, you may die out here.
Did you tell people about specifically the weapon that you chose for this? And, like, I know folks who know you will know that you enjoy this weapon, but specifically where you got it and why you choose it over others.
So I got a new bow. I actually have a couple of new bows for the first time in like 5 years. But I ran into a fellow with last name of Broderick in Alberta. And we got to hunt together one morning. And over the course of looking over the Alberta plain for mule deer, we were talking, and this guy has a hand in making bows with Bushman bows in Florida. And he, you know, it's like, you know, if you don't want to spend money, you don't look through somebody else's binoculars, right?
That's right. Like,
boy, I want to get those binoculars. But we were very much on the same page as far as like hunting style, what we held in high regard, what was most important, what we disdained. And I was like, I got to ask you about your bow. Like that is a beautiful bow. And he kind of walked me through his and I kept thinking about it. And finally I emailed him and asked, hey, want to ask you about making me a bow, and he never got back to me. And then I asked him again, he never got back to me, and I thought, maybe it's just not for me. And then finally he's like, hey, give me a shout if you want to talk about bows. And long story short, I got a longbow, first longbow ever. And so yeah, I'm hunting with a longbow.
Obviously, I've shot longbows, recurve bows, and even self bows and things like that. But in the scenario of axis deer, I mean, we were in a camp with 7 or 8 other rifle hunters, and the three of us, and then one other older bow hunter by the name of Steve. Steve was a badass.
Yeah.
Steve was buds with old Fred Bear. They were bros.
Yep. Now that's just friend picture.
Yeah, he had a you know how. We, as new age, social media people, we post things. Everybody that is over, 40 can remember the days where you'd show up at a trade show or show up at somebody's house and you'd have a flip, like a photo album of all your, like, printed out photos. And old Steve had a photo album of all the stuff he killed.
Now, this isn't bragging.
He'd say, yeah, this ain't bragging, boys, but here's this moose I killed. Now, this ain't bragging, but here's these whitetails I killed. Everywhere from 140 inches to 180 inches.
But, you know what was cool is he prefaced all of this before the album ever came out. And you could tell there was absolutely no BS in this man's voice. But he was like, I'm so excited to see you boys here.
Yep.
And he pointed at Ben, because Ben killed a buck the first day with his bow. He said, and I was so proud of you when you came in with that buck the first night. And I mean that. I was so proud of you because you guys are the new generation of bow hunters.
Yep. And he'd been bow hunting for like 40 years.
Yeah, this guy's 70.
And the annals of bow hunting is all the years.
Yeah.
That's all the years that there are in bow hunting. And so here's a guy who knew Fred Bear. He's been hunting his whole life. And comes in there pretty unassumingly. He's not flashy about anything. He's a, for lack of a better term, sweet old man that was climbing up a tree to shoot an axis deer, which I believe he did. And it's cool to hear somebody like that, because if you and I are lucky enough to be in Steve's position, you know, 40 years from now, and be able to tell people that story. That, hey, I knew Casey from Hushin as well. We'll probably show them photos of Casey and I at the table. Like, this is a real conversation. What did he say? This is a real conversation with Fred Bear. Let me tell you how it went.
The very last, so this guy, Steve, has done, you know, if you were somebody who was like, here's a couple of pinnacles, like ultimate goals as a bow hunter, this guy's done them.
Yep.
And they're in this photo album that he keeps in the jockey box, the glove box of his truck. And the very last page of this book is this quote, his, I think, most prized picture.
That's what he said. Most prized picture.
And it's him as a younger man speaking with Fred Bear at a table. And he says, this is not just picture taken. We were friends. And, you know, he had a good story about Fred Bear, but it was really neat because there's like some gravitas with Steve. He's like, this is,
it was
important to see it passed on.
Yeah. And it was important to him. And it was like, he felt like we were this, you know, he could probably see himself in us, I'm sure, at some level when he was that, you know, younger guy talking to Fred Bear.
Well, I think he says, like, you guys remind me of me. He's like, hey, you guys just want to do this with your bow and rah. It was neat.
Yeah. What a neat person. And one of the reasons you go on things like this is stumble on a guy like that. But is there, I mean, back to the longbow and why you do that. I mean, obviously we're all looking for a struggle, right? You know, you want to overcome. You want some of us are just trying to find that struggle and whatever it is. Is there anything like in your mind that connects you to a longbow? Is there some piece of you that wants to harken back to Steve or harken back to, you know, Fred Bear, or is it just something you enjoy doing as a craft?
Oh, I think I'd probably be lying if I said there's not some of all that. I mean, really what got my wheels turning on jumping over to something other than a compound bow, which I certainly don't know the statistics, but I would say is by far and away the most popular archery item out there, is just the fact that I was having a lot of difficulty in tuning bows and mentally knowing that my bow was in tune and knowing that I was making a mistake and not, you know, thinking that the bow was out of tune or I had the opposite experience. I have just a lemon of a bow one time, and boy, I was damn near in tears a couple of times. I wanted to go to something simple, eliminate as much as possible. And, you know, I had a bad experience other than the tuning where I wounded the only bull elk that I've ever wounded, and the sight on my bow that I had Loctited in there had actually come loose through, you know, I'm sure just hard use.
Yep.
And I whacked this bull. I saw it several days later. It was a non-lethal hit, but still, you know, I'd try to do everything I can to eliminate that possibility at all, and kind of came to the conclusion that I'm not doing everything I can with all these moving parts that you got to have some trust in. So I wanted to have more of the onus on myself than anything.
Right.
And that's really why I wanted to do it. And, you know, I was really sick of, to the other part of your question, I was really sick of kind of playing the game of like, well, you got to have a new bow every year and you got to have this sight and this rest and this, you know, list goes on and on and on. And, you know, and I was hearing lots of conversations of, well, if you're a serious archery hunter, you're going to have a new bow every year. And I thought, bullshit. I know lots of guys that...
Thank you for saying that. Thank you. I go through a lot of hardships switching bows every year.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, that I think that is a part of the equation. And you know, I think ultimately the biggest part was is when I picked up that recurve and was super frustrated trying to figure out how to be a proficient shooter with the recurve, I was having an incredible amount of fun shooting with that bow.
Yeah.
And so much more fun than I was having with the compound. And, you know, truthfully, I was like, I am not going to get another bow. I'm going to have this bow for the rest of my life and call it good. And, yeah, and then now here we are, and I got two new bows, a new recurve and this long bow. But
you haven't gotten a new bow every year, have you?
I have not.
So at least you bucked that trend.
I have bucked that trend. But this, I felt a little fruity, but I had to call this dude. And when the longbow finally showed up, I had to call this guy. And I was like, I got to tell you, there's just something about this thing. Like, I know this bow and I are going to do good things. Like, there's just something about it. Like, I just love the way it shoots, and I still have a lot of learning to do. I got thousands of arrows to shoot, but yeah, I'm digging it. So
what's your arrow broadhead setup? Because I was interested in that, how you set that up.
Yeah, so and this started back in the compound days, but I shoot, you know, single bevel, so the blade is only angled and sharpened on one side. Single blade broadhead, and they're pretty darn stout. I've been shooting Strickland Helix forever, and a friend of mine that I met through Backcountry Hunters and Anglers, this guy Jarrett Babinchak, he started a company called Bone Broadheads, and he gave me a set of those broadheads a couple years ago now. And you know, I just don't switch over to things for the sake of switching over to things. Like,
yep.
Especially when it comes to the regard I have for these animals. Like, if I find something that works, it is very, very hard for me to switch. So I got this new setup, and every bow is different. And this long bow is a lot faster, so I had to shorten my arrows a bunch. And it was on the verge of being on a different spine, and these bone broadheads are 200 grains, whereas my Strickland Helix that I was shooting were 150 grains, and the 200 grain heads, I think, fit this setup a little bit better. So, long story short, this is, and these are cut on contact heads, but they're that adds heads. It's like a chisel tip is what some people call it. You know, everybody says, like, the ideas for, like, punching through bone is the main point of these types of broadheads. But if you break it down to nothing, they fly fantastic. They're super tough. And one of the things that I really love about them is you can sharpen them.
Yep.
And with a recurve... you have a really good chance of actually finding your arrow. Or with a longbow, you got a really good chance of finding your arrow. So you can sharpen those things up and reuse them. And you know, I think it's something I'm getting a little more averse to as I'm getting older. Is I just don't like the throwaway nature of so many things these days. And you know, we talked a lot about knives on this trip. You know, I had this, or I still have this awesome knife that my dad gave me from this really well-known knife maker out of Bonner, Montana, Ruana. And I've sharpened that thing up a gajillion times, many, many times in my younger days, the absolute wrong way. but, you know, that's like a heirloom piece, and I'd want to have more of that stuff around, and so yeah, I enjoy you know, I like being able to grab that broadhead, you know, give it a real inspection, make sure it's not bent in any way, so it will still fly straight, or sharpen, put that edge back on, sharpen it up, buff it up, and hopefully try to put it through another critter.
Yeah. You feel like, you know, we go into a camp like we did this week, and there's a lot of reactions between people that are hunting with different styles and different weapons, and different age groups, of course, in this camp. Everybody looks at you with a longbow, and I feel like most of them think that it's next to impossible for you to kill something, let alone kill a buck of any sort or size. In fact, our outfitter was continually making comments like, "Well, you'll never kill a black buck," or "I'll buy your next hunt if you shoot a black." Like, "Oh, really?" Or, you know, "We'll see about this with this. See how you do." You yes. feel like that's I feel like if I was in that position, I'd be like, "All right, man, that's one of the reasons that I do this, is because there is people out there that can't conceive of how hard it is to do this, and just are contented and happy cracking things with rifles and making those comments." I gather that's probably the same for you.
Yeah, kind of. I mean, to a degree, I absolutely love a challenge. I try to be objective, though, also, because, you know, I'm a single dude, no kids. I get a lot of time to hunt, and I get a lot of time to practice, or as much time as I want to make for myself, really. So, yeah. The other side is there's a lot of folks out there that I've met, and before I jump in, a big hang up I had to going over to, you know, the traditional archery, you know, recurve longbow, self bow, whatever, side of things was, man, I have guided folks, I've been around folks, I've been on archery shoots with folks that you know, have this way of thinking when they're shooting their traditional equipment that I do not agree with at all if you're going to go hunt a living creature with it, which is like, oh, yeah, some days I got it, some days I don't.
Yeah.
It's like, nope. Well, that's, yeah, then you can't hunt with that.
Yeah, that's real unlucky for that,
yes.
that creature
you
came across.
So there's a lot of bad examples out there, and there's plenty of bad examples in every sport, but or every pursuit. Or
do you have a threshold when you're doing it? Like, hey, I'm ready now, or not quite ready. Is there a threshold, or are you just?
Oh yeah, absolutely. So, you know, I mean, I chose to bring this longbow with me. I have not had. I mean, not even a fraction of arrows through this thing as I have with my recurve at home. You know, my recurve right situation, I'm proficient out to, you know, about 45 yards.
Yeah.
With, like, clear line of sight, I can, you know, tap a target all day long. With this, you know, by the end of our hunt, you know, stepping out at lunch and stuff, I was whacking the target well out there at about, you know, 35. But I was really, really not really willing to go beyond 20 yards.
Yeah.
You know, and that's a serious setback. Yeah. 20 to 30.
Hey, man.
It's huge. So
situational ethics.
Yeah.
Reared its ugly head. Like, not ugly in this case.
Yep. So, yeah, absolutely you have to have limitations. But, you know, I absolutely hope that everybody listening realizes that every single... You are the most limiting factor,
yep.
Regardless of your weapon, right? So if you got a 30-06 and you can't hit the broadside of a barn, you better not be cracking off shots at any distance in that situation. So
After 3 years of work, our follow-up to the Meat Eater Fish and Game Cookbook is here. It's the Meat Eater Outdoor Cookbook, wild game recipes for the grill, smoker, campfire, and camp stove. Here is your book for everything that's best cooked or eaten outside, from grilling to open fire cooking to Dutch ovens to smokers to barbecue to backpacking meals to how to pull off the perfect fish fry. With pit stops along the way for lessons about ice age cooking methods and the best 5 ways to construct a cooking fire you can be proud of. And of course, we're focusing on wild game and fish here with over 100 recipes, including stuffed venison burgers 3 ways, wild duck with aji verde sauce, a jerky made with cola, a gin and tonic made with fire charred lemons, and grilled frog legs made with a sticky sweet sauce. This ain't your normal cookbook, so be prepared to be surprised. Get your copy now. For more info, visit themeateater.com or buy it wherever books are sold.
Is that something, I mean, obviously, when I was a kid, that was instilled in me pretty early on. I mean, your upbringing, was that non-negotiable pretty early on, or was it?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. You know, the bulk of my, I guess, formal shooting training came through this outfitter named Larry Pendleton out of Stevensville, Montana. And he was a hunting mentor of mine and ultimately the first outfitter that I worked for. And absolutely loved this man to death. And he could shoot a long, long way. And I shot long distances but we shot, I was talking about this the other day, like I shot so much and all Larry did was reload and shoot. And man, we would spend hours when we go out to Eastern Montana and set up camp. We were shooting all the time.
Yeah.
Like I said, we'd sit there and he'd find a cow patty, a dried up cow patty out there in the prairie. And we'd have 22. He had these nylon 66.
You were shooting the shit, Larry?
We were shooting the shit. Literally
shooting the shit, Larry.
And he'd chuck that cow patty out there and we'd shoot it. And, you know, the game was just keep that cow patty rolling until it disintegrated. And then he'd find another one and do it again, you know, and it was fun and games, but it was absolutely building skill.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that was really the, and honestly, so much, I guess my ethical compass comes from that dude and that education.
So. Yeah. Well, I mean, so we have. On the last podcast with Casey, we talked a lot about failure and like what it and success, but moreover, like what failure does to you in hunting and what it means and why it's a little more serious than failure in golf or failure in, you know, a race of any kind, and why hunting failure means a lot more than and really many other hobbies or sports or however you want to couch whatever you're doing outside of your daily routine. And we have a story of success this week, a pretty badass success if you ask me, pretty unique, and then a story of failure that you told, I hope you're willing to tell, about a different hunt in a different place. Can you weave those two stories together, just tell them back to back, or just kind of give us an idea of like what that success this week meant to you, and then, you know, juxtaposed to that failure we talked about a little bit ago?
Yeah. Boy, I don't know how to succinctly do this. So I guess
don't worry about succinctly.
Okay.
Well, we'll be home at my house in about 40 minutes. So there's your succinctness.
Driving through these Texas towns, man, there's some stuff that I do not expect. You know, it's like it's kind of funny to me to I got to remind myself that Texas is a hell of a lot older than Montana, even though there's some there's some similarities here and there.
Well, we're driving through Johnson City. A lot of Lyndon B. Johnson activity here.
And let's not forget Lady Bird.
Lady Bird Street. Lady Bird Street.
So it was this morning. This morning, I jumped in with Ben and Casey, and they had kind of started brushing a ground blind.
Very poorly.
Last night. And we kind of got out the door a little bit late this morning, and then, Ben and Case were like, yeah, these deer, they really want to get to this water hole, and brush blind is next to the water hole. And we did some tromping around yesterday, but, only water around type of deal.
Wow. So, and I was foolish because we did tromp around this water hole pretty good, spooked a bunch of deer off of it invariably. And I was like, I don't know. I think these deer, there's a bunch of scent everywhere, and there's just been pushed around. And boy, was I wrong.
The three of us go into this brush blind, partially built brush blind, and we have two folding chairs for the three of us. And as per usual, the action starts happening before we're like really dialed. And man, it was wild. So there were deer that came right into the water. Ben, you were trying to fill your doe tag with your bow.
Yeah, and we were about, from the center of this water hole, we were probably about 40 yards, say.
Yes.
So on the close side, 30 yards. On the far side, 50 yards. And that doe was like right in the center. And she just was, as these things do, they don't hang around too long. They're not too interested in having a long drink, as it were.
And so, to picture it, I guess, if, let's just say, the chairs are facing to, let's say, the north. The water hole would be to the west, and the fence line runs east-west. And there's a road in between us and the fence is probably at 15 yards. And the dead center of the road's 12 yards, and so it's pretty tight. And these deer are coming from the opposite side of the fence, and they are picking different spots in the fence to jump over and go to the water.
Yeah, we just happen to be on the right side of what they need in between them and what they have to get at, which is water. And that seemed to me that was about the only water source anywhere close.
Yes. And it was apparent that there are a ton of deer in the area, and they wanted to get there. So, right out of the gate, here's deer coming in from the opposite side of the fence. Ben and Casey had described, they jump here. We want them to walk to the west. When they go behind this tree, you can draw, and then there's your shot. But sometimes what was happening is they go to the east when they jump the fence, and they, basically caught us by surprise. Well, of course, that's what happens, and there's these two really nice bucks that just, as fate would have it, jump the fence before the rest of the herd, and they are just right in our lap, and I have the longbow, and they're coming to the east side, which is my right side, and I'm trying to pivot over one butt cheek on the folding chair. Arrow knocked, and all of a sudden this axis deer is at what, like 5 yards maybe?
Yeah, I mean, he just turns the wrong, these things turn the wrong way, and then they're in your grill. I mean, they're, and you can't draw, you can't move. these are cagey critters. And I'm, you know, crouching tiger hidden dumbass behind a bush. And Casey's trying to film, and you're trying to maneuver a giant long stick with colorful feathers on it.
Yes, and I, you know, I'll be the absolute first to tell you that I just do not spend a lot of time in a tree stand or in a ground blind or in a blind at all. And I was a little unsure of exactly how things were set to go, and there was a doe staring right into my soul from across the fence, and it's like, well, you know, it's a very classic scenario, right? It's like, when do you draw? And when you draw, you know you're going to alert this doe, and but you got to draw to shoot. And as this is equations running through your head, that buck's right in your lap, and you know, we blow that out. So yeah, I'm like, well, boy, I feel.
Feel inadequate, I believe. Well, I said. This is our last. Yeah, feel inadequate. This is like, this is our last morning. We have to drive back as we're doing now. And the outfitter doesn't think you can do it. Everybody in camp is kind of like, "Hey, look at the weird guy with the stick bow."
Yeah,
and that's kind of feelings in the air. But also, it's a new bow, and you don't get to Texas to hunt axis deer all that often. And there's not a whole lot of folks out there that do that, I don't believe.
Well, so yeah, and honestly, that was certainly on my mind to more than anything else. It's kind of like, boy, am I an idiot for not just picking up a gun and shooting a deer because I have the opportunity, this awesome opportunity to, you know, hunt and shoot an axis deer, and instead I want to put, you know, the way I want to do it above everything else, and try to get it with this longbow. So, you know, that's kind of like, boy, and here's this deer at 5 yards, and
well,
and
you
still
also
couldn't
have
make it work, right?
The folks back in Ketchum who are just poking you, like, hey, yeah, you bringing some? You gonna bring that meat back?
Yes.
Have some steaks for me when you get back. So you got that pressure on you too. You don't want to, for your own personal challenge, have left meat on the table.
Exactly. Yeah. And, yeah. So I got first light office. Is like, hey, axis deer, real tasty. Better bring one home.
Because we're going to eat it all. You're not going to eat any of it.
Right. Yeah. And I love sharing meat and cooking and stuff. So that part of it is fun also. But. And we talked about it at the beginning of the hunt. It's like, man, I would, above anything, the conversation wasn't how big of a deer do you want to shoot. It was, man, I'd love to bring some axis deer back. So
that's right.
So yeah, and you know, here's this buck 5 yards, another buck at like 7 yards, and still couldn't make it happen. I'm just like, oh God, am I just being a jackass? So, take a beat. We run around. Ben very correctly surmises that we just need to brush the blind in a lot more. So we haul in any sort of loose debris that we can dig up, and we start stacking it around, and we make ourselves a much better blind.
Yeah, because they weren't getting us with their most of the time, not getting us with their noses. They were hitting us with the eyes, and that's what. And it was just when they're that close to your grill, and they're staring at your eyes, are 5 yards away. It's not a whole lot you can do other than duck behind something in front of you. So,
yeah, and so then we set up again. And keep in mind too, like there were some serious times, some intense times, but the three of us are buddies, and we're probably whispering a little bit louder than we should be and shooting the shit the whole time, and
yes,
making up on funny scenarios about strange hybrid creatures. And
yes, we had basically created our own Texas ranch, whereas we had our own exotic species. Hippo and a jackalope had sex and made a hippolope at some point.
Yes.
A tiny bouncing hippo with big ears.
The Havapo.
Havapo.
It's a javelina hippo cross.
Because we sell hunts for them.
So we're having fun, and then, you know, another group of deer start working in, and again, and it's certainly not the way I have seen it, but a buck leads, jumps over the fence. This time it does go west. It goes behind that tree that Ben and Casey said would be the tree to draw behind. Draw. Buck steps out, has absolutely no clue. And, you know, aim. It's still walking, but, you know, one thing that I am quite certain of with, at least with my skills with the traditional equipment, is shooting at alert animals is not good. It's a slow arrow, and this is only 10 yards. May not have mattered at all, but, you know, very confident in my shot and take the shot, and bizarre things that I have never seen happen at that point. So
things I had never seen any of it. I had never seen mustachioed man from Idaho with a longbow shoot at anything, let alone an axis buck.
The deer, I mean, the deer pancakes on it onto its opposite side and proceeds to, I mean, it was stunned, like deader than the wedge, just to quiver for a second, and then started kicking its legs. And I mean, in its tracks, though, like you could see the tracks in the dirt. That thing tipped over in place. I sprinted out of the blind. And we'll have to review the footage, because supposedly there is some footage here. And I distinctly remember I hear Ben saying, "It's down." And Casey goes, "Wow." I think a little bit of shock in there.
And all
I could think is, you know, I must have spined this thing, because the way it dropped, and I have seen some weird spinal shots where the critter does just this and then it hops up never to be seen again. So I, you know, sprinted over there, put another arrow in it, and we kind of proceeded to watch this buck expire. And there's some more detail we can go in there, but to the original question, you know, this is, so there's a little bit of defeat, and there's a little bit of and there is success in this story.
Yeah.
You know, a story that I certainly have talked about before, but you know, my experience in Alberta last year, the animal that I had encountered and stalked through crazy adverse conditions, things that exposed terrain that you probably shouldn't be able to stalk a wise old mule deer in, and did everything right for once and got in super, super close, and proceeded to be extremely patient and wait for that right shot, and I missed, and this deer was, you know, the caliber of deer that no exaggeration, I will truly never have never be able to likely hunt again.
Once, like, in a lifetime opportunity.
Yes. I mean, just seeing this animal was something that, you know, very, very serious mule deer hunters will may never see.
And you said even when you saw this deer, you thought, "Oh man," and didn't get a stalk on him. Oh, I was lucky to have seen that.
Yeah, three days prior, I'd seen that deer, and I was
like, "What about your business?"
Yeah, I was like, "Wow, I am an incredibly fortunate human being for having seen that deer, even though I will never see it again." And I just saw it from, you know, 2 miles away, and was planning in my head how to stock it, and then some cattle came in and bumped it out, and I never saw it again. And then the last day, there he, you know, I caught a glimpse of him and relocated him and got in there, and it was an amazing, amazing experience. And, you know, for an really just an incredibly brief couple of seconds, soul crushing, but really, like, that disappeared very fast. And again, just like fortunate to be that close and in the presence of that type of animal. And you know, you gotta learn from that. And it was a series of little teeny tiny victories over the course of hours to get into range on that deer, and a series of little teeny tiny victories to get into a shooting position from laying flat on your stomach for hours, and series of little teeny tiny victories to be patient enough to wait for the right shot, and then, you know, the failure of missing. But
it's just a good juxtaposition of, you know, you're in Texas and you have a super jumpy deer that are always on point, especially near water holes. This one happens to just be so locked in on getting a drink that he doesn't even care that we're 10 yards away.
Yes.
And then you get an arrow in him. Not only do you get a good arrow in him, but he drops in his tracks for what seems to be no real good reason other than he got thumped pretty hard with a heavy arrow, and he got probably hit through the shoulder on his far side.
Yeah, and that's what, you know, I was very anxious to start the post-mortem, the necropsy, start looking at where that hole was. And yeah, it was, you know, it was a higher lung shot. And I mean, the only thing I can figure is maybe that deer was trying to react to the arrow a little bit, even though I couldn't see it with my eye. And that arrow impacted hard. And, you know.
Yeah, he was anchored, man. Because that's what I was, when you got up, I was yelling, he's down, he's staying down. Because I was looking at, like, when he was trying to get up, kind of how much, because was he getting to his knees? Was his back legs coming up off the ground? No, he was lifting his head and his haunches up, and that's it. But he couldn't move, which makes you think, well, he must be spined somehow, but he wasn't.
Yeah, and the bruising on the opposite shoulder, it didn't go through the opposite shoulder. The bruising on the opposite shoulder went all the way to the, you know, to the outside of that shoulder. So, yeah, that arrow whacked him hard.
Yeah. Well, I just think, to me, you have this success you have in a pretty unique situation on a unique animal, and then you have this failure in a pretty unique situation on a unique animal. And what I'm hearing a little bit, correct me if I'm wrong, but it's like these experiences are the wins, and those the two things, the two results are just the two results. Because, you know, we certainly didn't jump up, down, and scream about the axis deer, and I'm sure you didn't want to quit bow hunting. Maybe you might have for a brief moment or 20. After you weren't in any way suicidal after you missed one. So it's like these results are important, but it's not all about that.
No, it's not. I mean, I'm not fooling myself. I'm hunting the way I choose to hunt, not the way I have to hunt to provide meat for myself, or provide meat at all, you know? And if it were, you know, just about the end result, I'd be going about things in a hell of a lot different manner. This is kind of a selfish pursuit. And I, you know, believe we talked about this before, but it is about, you know, honing your game, honing your craft, and you know, I there's one pet peeve of mine out there, and it's like this whole struggle stick thing. Like, I just, if this were not a proficient killing tool, I wouldn't use it.
Yeah.
Because that.
Yeah, because
it just wouldn't be fair to the animal. I mean,
and it comes off as vanity. It can come off as vanity. It doesn't always. But sometimes it seems like some folks are shooting a longbow for their own vanity to say, look at me, look how hard this is. Because it does magnify your success when you shoot something with a longbow. Because it is so hard to do. And it is a path that not a lot of folks choose. And it takes a lot of hard work and training to do it. So I think that's, you know, step forward to compound bow versus rifle or muzzleloader. Modern firearm, and so you can make a lot of those comparisons if you want. But
Kent Carruth said it best. He said, you know, the best thing about hunting with traditional equipment is you get to hunt a lot more, right? It's because
I love him.
You're not putting that meat in the freezer every time you go out. So and there's absolute truth in that to me. Like, you know, the hunting stops when you let that arrow go and it connects, or that bullet fly and it connects. And man, I love the hunting aspect, and I love the fact that I will never be as good as I feel I should be.
Yeah. And I mean, I think also that end result thing, this is something we were talking about earlier that I was intrigued just to talk more about, which was, that deer in Alberta was not only a once-in-a-lifetime deer, but, you know, might have made its way into certain books.
Yes.
And those books, being in those books, would have given you personally, especially because of the way that you took that deer, quite the leap in hunting circles. You know, like an esteem or, like, status. Because what you did was pretty damn awesome. And
I confided to you guys. That definitely flashed through my mind then. But what also flashed through my mind is, you know, this was a big enough animal to where, you know, I would have taken a lot of pictures of it, and I'm sure my buddies would have taken a lot of pictures of it, and we would have talked about it like crazy, 1,000 times more than the miss that we're talking about, the mistake that we're talking about. And there would have been, you know, a lot of talk about, like, oh my gosh, look at this, is so awesome, such an amazing feat. And the reality is kind of undeservedly so, right?
Yeah. Yeah, that's the big point for me, is like, that animal is, I mean, you're not lucky to come across it. I mean, it's just every time you step up and pick the binos up, you're performing, you know, an activity that has a little bit of luck involved, like right place, right time, right? But you put yourself in that place, and you spent the time out there to be there when that deer was. But yeah, there's a little luck involved, and we were talking about, if somebody goes out tomorrow and shoots a world record elk, does that all of a sudden make them the best elk hunter?
Right, the world's best.
The world's best elk hunter. And I think the answer is flatly no. And I'm sure in the past in the hunting industry, it seemed like that might have been true, maybe. That we kind of let ourselves get fooled by instant success, or even to some level consistent success, to the point where we were using that as like this community standing. Oh man, you kill a lot of elk. Well, you must be the best elk hunter, without looking at the conditions in which you're doing it.
Yes.
And the dedication you have for the craft of whatever you're choosing to do. I think that's a great conversation to look at, based on that scenario that you were in. You know, are you suddenly the best bow hunter ever if you took a difficult endeavor, made it more difficult, and then killed, you know, one of the biggest deer ever to walk on four legs? That was a blacktail and a whitetail got together. I mean, yeah, man, that's an achievement to be lauded, but that's not a marker of greatness. It's just a marker of greatness in that one situation if it would have happened.
Yeah, to put this in context is to successfully kill that forked horn, you have to do all of the same right things that you do to successfully kill that 200-inch deer.
Yeah.
Now, that forked horn may, on occasion, put itself in spots a little bit easier to sneak up on it. Maybe. But it still doesn't want to die.
That's right. That's right. Well, and we were saying, too, that, you know, say this is a 240-inch mule deer. A 200-inch mule deer is not 7 years younger.
No.
You're talking like these you know, relatively small variances in its genetics and its diet and its stress levels and just a lot of things.
Yeah. Big, wide open public lands. You're talking about an animal that won a genetic lottery, maybe got a little bit better feed, had a little bit less stress in its life that year.
Yeah. And was it, I mean, does the 30 extra inches of antler make it smarter than the one that is 200 inches? No, it doesn't. We just covet and value, and in my opinion, you know, fetishize or overly value these things to the extent that clouds our judgment on like what makes us good at this thing. You know, what makes us good at hunting? Why are we good at it? And what the hell does it matter if we are? Like, if you're proficient and you love what you do, and you care like you do of being proficient, no matter what you choose to do, what the hell does it matter?
Yeah, man, because I what matters to me is you take the right shot, which is when you let that arrow go or squeeze that trigger, you know something is going to die.
Yeah.
Now, it doesn't always happen that way, and it sure as heck hasn't happened all that way for me all the time, but you know, I don't let that thing go and be like, boy, I hope this works.
Yeah, I mean, and so you deserve all the credit in the world for that. As every other hunter does who works hard at what they do and cares about it. Even in any of your weekend warrior, if you go out to the range and make sure your rifle's on and you understand where you're going, what you're doing, you deserve what you get. You deserve the output from the input. Like, that's what you deserve. And we were talking about you can tell me the gentleman's name, but the guy who killed the world record elk in Montana on public land, this is a guy who was a legit hunter.
Yeah, Steve Felix.
Steve Felix. And Steve Felix kills his world record elk on public land. And you've had conversations with him where you can just kind of tell he's legit. He does it the right way.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I'm always super very revitalizing to have conversations with guys, because there's so much hubris involved and with a lot of folks that, well, I got the world record or I got the state record or, you know, I got a 200-inch mule deer, 200-inch whitetail or 300-inch bull or 500-inch bull or whatever. So, but yeah, this guy has the world record archery elk, public land, and he hunts his butt off, and he hasn't been a dedicated, I'm going to kill the biggest thing all the time, that's what I do guy until recently. And it's just neat. He's like, yeah, boy, you know, Montana, you pass a bull up, you may never get another shot. And growing up in Montana, I'll tell you, that's the truth. And he's like, but, you know, getting towards 60 and I'm got a lot more time to hunt these days. And I thought, well, I should probably try to get something big. Got a lot of small bulls. So, it was great.
That's a great example. And that's a guy who should be celebrated for what he did that day. And and for who he is and his dedication to hunting and how much he loves it, right? I mean, he doesn't need – boy, he already has a trophy. He doesn't need – he doesn't need one. He doesn't need another one.
Yeah, and, you know, he – my big question to him when we spoke this year, I said, well, Steve, man, what – how was it driving into your spot? And did you see any other folks? Said not a single person. And he hunted his butt off and he found another nice bull. And you know, he's a guy who's like, man, it's just a great spot. And he didn't get the bull, never let an arrow fly. So,
well, you were saying that a lot of people, his, you know, either friends of his or people that kind of knew the history of guys killing world records were like, hey, you got to cash in on this baby.
Yes.
Like, you got to get somebody to pay you for this. You got to get sponsors. You got to go on tour. You got to, you know, you start wearing new clothes.
Monetize it.
Yeah, get new carpet. You got a lot of stuff you got to do. And you know, my
did
point.
Did you say that, get new carpet?
Yeah, you got to get, you're just the Seinfeld where he's like, oh, I can't have a menage a trois. I'd have to get new carpet. I'd have to start wearing different clothes. And I'm a menage a trois guy. But when you're a world record elk guy, things are supposed to be different, right? But for the wrong reasons, they're supposed to be different because now you're this exalted like hunter. But like let's celebrate the animal for what it is, because the animal is special. Let's celebrate the hunter for who he is and what he did that day. That's about as far as it goes. And does he deserve to be on the cover of Field & Stream? Sure. I'm not saying that he was, but does he deserve that kind of coverage? Yeah, because I love great stories, and so does everybody else. Does he deserve to get a bunch of sponsors and be rich along his wildest dreams? I guess that's for the market to declare, but I would question the motivations there.
Yes. Yes. But yeah, I mean, it's nice to see those guys that still have that passion for hunting. And just like our buddy Steve, coming out of the Axis Deer Camp, you know, that guy, I don't know if I could have been around him when he was younger. He's so fired up to hunt right now. And
for him to say, I'm proud of you guys, was like the weirdest, most awesome thing that you could hear from a guy like that. You know,
I'm proud of you.
I'm proud. Like, this guy feels a connection because I'm carrying a bow. I could be some asshole. I could have, you know, shot that deer in the guts and then picked up a rifle. He doesn't know, but he just feels like he sees a little bit of himself in us, which was fantastic.
It's amazing. Yeah. And I have been in camps where the first hunter to come in with a bull, nobody talked to.
Yeah.
First day, first morning, first day, first bull, nobody talked to, because all of a sudden it was a reflection on them. Why did they not get whatever? And this guy marched right up to you, and I was so proud of you. I got to tell you boys something. I was so proud of you when you came in with that deer. I mean, my jaw dropped. I mean, that's what an adult is right there.
He was there, I believe, by himself.
Yes.
Where was he from? I can't remember where he's from.
Illinois.
He came all the way from Illinois by himself because he loves the bow hunt. And he had a crossbow, and he was a little self-conscious about his crossbow because he didn't want to, you know, he's a Pope and young guy, didn't want to get judged. But was saying it in just a sweet sort of like, hey, you know, I'm getting older, my arm hard to pull that bow back. But I just take crossbow every once in a while. You know, I was like, dude, that's okay, man.
Yeah.
Like, you're passionate about hunting. You've been doing it for 40 years. You've earned the right to choose the way you want to do it.
Your shoulder should be shot.
Yeah, your shoulder should be falling off by now.
You shouldn't be able to lift a fork, let alone lift a crossbow.
Yeah. Yeah. And that, I mean, it's guys like that. You meet guys like that, and it's like, hey, if I could have Steve's attitude in 40 years, if I could have Steve's accomplishments and just Steve's general disposition, I think I'd be a winner. So,
yeah, absolutely.
Appreciate you, Steve. You're the man.
Darn right.
We're pulling up to my house now. See those deer right there? They live in my yard.
The See O'Brien them? Deer Preserve. Oh, yeah. My gosh. Look at this deer.
They sleep right in the yard. This is my yard, but that's my yard. And they just chill out, man. And they have fawns all back in these this tall grass because they obviously like that protection. So I've probably seen, I don't know how many fawns. Lots of fawns, though, get born right there here in Texas. Hill Country. Gateway to the Hill Country, Dripping Springs, Texas, everybody. And I want to close this podcast by telling the story.
And that Ryan, gal is pregnant.
She's very pregnant. So she's going, she'll get right back there and have that one. I gotta close this podcast by telling the story. I almost forgot about it, but then I said Dripping Springs and I remembered what was going down. So here's my front yard, and I'll show you the deer that are just eating my grass. Shite heads. Laying
right there. there's a whole family unit laying in Ben's front yard.
Yeah, we'll just keep driving around so as to not disturb my family. So here's the story. This is great. Everybody, you're going to love it. I love it. I'm looking
at it. I have to interrupt just briefly. You have a John Deere riding lawnmower.
Yes.
And I just...
Is that too cliche?
It's not... I don't know if it's cliche, but I just... For some reason, I can perfectly picture you riding around in that thing.
You don't have a lawn to mow there at the
condo?
At the DIY condo?
Nope.
Oh, man. When you have a kid and you're mowing the lawn, it's like meditation. Very loud, noisy, hot as shit meditation. That's what it's like.
I'm sorry. Get back to your story, please.
It's a very important story. I gotta talk to somebody out there in the world, probably listening right now. I know he's listening. He told me he does. So, you know, I play in this hunt, and I pride myself on my logistical abilities. It's one of the things, one of my few, other than talking, one of my few marginal talents. And Mr. Callahan, I was like, hey, man, come on down to Texas. And after some convincing and massaging, he was like, yep, I'll do it. And I said, come on down on the 28th of May, Memorial Day. He said, really? Yeah, okay. Bought his ticket. Well, in the meantime, I talked to the outfitter. It turned out May 29th was a better day to go. And then I've just neglected to tell Mr. Callahan. And then I neglected to remember that he was coming in on the 28th. So I was out in my backyard shooting my bow, getting ready. I'd just ridden around on my John Deere. And I get a text from Ryan. I'm at the airport. And my first reaction was like, oh, tomorrow you're at the airport, right? Not at the airport today. But no. No. He was there at the airport. And I was in my dad clothes doing yard work, shooting my bow. So I jumped in my truck and I sped down the road. Oh, shit. So I jumped in my truck. And I sped down the road that we're currently on because I didn't want Ryan to have to wait too long with the hipsters in the Austin airport. I'm afraid he was going to get accosted or you'd never know what those hipsters are going to do. You don't know. They're unpredictable. And then, so I'm speeding down this road and I'm talking on the phone, trying to get the day organized. And, what do I see? The cop pulling me over. This cop pulls me over, comes to the door of the car, says, sir, you're going X mile an hour over the speed limit. And takes my license. Oh, Ben O'Brien. Oh, cool. We've met before. I was like, oh, yeah. All right. I assume like that means like we're cool, man. Like we're feeling... You did something wrong, but I'll let it go.
And this stern warning.
Stern warning. And this officer goes back to his car. He comes back and he says, I'm going to issue a citation, but I got to tell you, I don't know if this does really a whole lot for you right now, but I love the podcast. He's like, who are you going to get? I told him I was going to the airport. I was like, oh, I'm going to get Ryan Callahan. He's like, oh, that's awesome. You guys are going to podcast? I said, well, yeah, of course we are. I'll make sure to give you a shout out. So Officer Smallwood from Dripping Springs, Texas, appreciate your service, man. I really do. Not saying that sarcastically. I'm sorry about that speeding. I'll keep it down because there's a lot more important to do than speed.
you know, it's just one failure that's going to lead to a lot of victories down the road, Officer Smallwood.
So. Look at you tying it together. Ryan Callahan putting a bow on the podcast. Well, thanks for coming for the second one. We've been in the truck for the entirety of our two conversations, so you're a huge part of the Hunting Collective, and I really appreciate you being willing to do that.
Oh, man, thank you so much. And, yeah, always fun to, you know, chew the fat with you.
Well, I'm happy to do it. Bye, everybody. That's it. That's all. Episode number 15 is in the books. Thank you to Mr. Callahan for joining me one more time on the Hunting Collective. I'd have him back every episode if I could. And I hope you enjoyed this conversation on our drive back to Austin, Texas, from Sonora across the Hill Country. I really like this one for a bunch of reasons, but just got to sit and cruise and listen to Ryan talk about what he liked to do. And his humble nature probably won't let him brag too much about his skills, but I can tell you on this hunt, he delivered and impressed me enough to want to pick up a longbow myself. So I may just do that, you know, in future hunts. So thanks to Ryan one more time, and thanks to everybody for listening to episode number 15. We'll be back next week with episode number 16 with Adam Janke. So Adam, from the Journal of Mountain Hunting, up next week. Good discussion on media and all that is entailed there. So check us out on thehuntingcollective.com. Articles, videos, podcasts, all kinds of stuff there for you to take in. Check me out on Instagram at BennyOB301. Keep following along. Big updates to come. Big changes, hopefully, for the podcast, for the positive. And hopefully we'll grow with you. And those of you who have listened, can't say enough about how much the support means to me and my family, my wife Hannah, my son James, everyone that has given us positive encouragement. It means a lot to our fam.
After 3 years of work, our follow-up to the Meat Eater Fish and Game Cookbook is here. It's the Meat Eater Outdoor Cookbook, wild game recipes for the grill, smoker, campfire, and camp stove. Here is your book for everything that's best cooked or eaten outside, from grilling to open fire cooking to Dutch ovens to smokers to barbecue to backpacking meals to how to pull off the perfect fish fry. With pit stops along the way for lessons about ice age cooking methods and the best 5 ways to construct a cooking fire you can be proud of. And of course, we're focusing on wild game and fish here with over 100 recipes, including stuffed venison burgers 3 ways, wild duck with aji verde sauce, a jerky made with cola, a gin and tonic made with fire charred lemons, and grilled frog legs made with a sticky sweet sauce. This ain't your normal cookbook, so be prepared to be surprised. Get your copy now. For more info, visit themeateater.com or buy it wherever books are sold.